fluff those letters off. They're too detailed. So go with the corporate crime letter to get corporate crime hearings and federal corporate crime reform.
You're tuned to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. You just heard the Ralph Nader Hour with Ralph Nader and crew. After a little station business, you'll hear Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund at 7 o'clock. Please stay tuned.
Tell me a story about your time at WBAI so I can let people know that you, in fact, have returned from retirement.
I retired because I was tired, but I found retirement more tiring than coming to BAI. BAI can be exhausting. Trump's there, and you have to yak about it. And if you're sitting at home, you're just shouting to the walls. When you have a program at WBAI, you can alert them about Donald Trump.
That's David Rothenberg. Tune in to any Saturday mornings from 8 to 10.
This is a well-oiled promotion, please.
Hello, I'm Isaac Ferguson. I'm inviting you to tune in on Saturday, 4 to 6 p.m. for Caribbean Voices and Beyond, when we will bring you news, views, and important issues affecting the Caribbean community in particular and the immigrant community in general. Tune in 4 to 6 p.m. to Caribbean Voices and Beyond on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the internet.
We're in a unique moment here. It's a moment where we have a chance to actually demonstrate our power.
Imhotep Gary Bird, heard on WBAI Friday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m.
I learned from Dr. Walter Fauntroy, who fought with Dr. King in the Civil Rights Movement, that there were five areas that they identified that they felt politics could control and hit. It was health, housing, education, economics, and social justice. The fact is, WBAI is a nexus for the progressive community to make those changes in all of those areas and has been decade after decade. I say to you again, whose station?
Our nation.
Whose control?
Our control.
Long live WBAI.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI.
Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. Okay, I'm just going to flat out tell you the title of the film we're discussing this morning, because the construction is kind of awkward. The title is PG:PsychoGoreMan. Now, I don't know why they did it that way. Maybe they're sending up E.T. the extraterrestrial. Although, when you see the title on the screen, they use the typeface that the MPAA uses for their PG rating. Although, ironically, this film is unrated, so maybe it's a dig at the MPAA as well. It's at the very least a PG-13, if not a straight-up R. Anyway, PG, PsychoGoreMan, which is available on demand, may not be the greatest Joe Dante film that Joe Dante didn't make, but in the absence of the real thing, it'll do quite nicely. A young suburban sister and brother, headstrong and occasionally abusive Mimi, played by Nita Josie Hanna, and acquiescent Luke, played by Owen Meyer, manage to unearth an imprisoned, all-powerful, intergalactic, world-destroying tyrant from their backyard, and only escape death because Mimi also has possession of a magical jewel crystal glowing thingy that puts the monster under her control. She names the behemoth PsychoGoreMan, because who wouldn't, and blithely shrugging off PG's repeated threats of horrible, painful death should he ever be free of her grip, oddly begins to bond with the guy. Complicating the friendship outside of PsychoGoreMan's overriding preference for death and destruction is that PsychoGoreMan is being hunted down by Pandora, played by no less than three actresses in her various forms, most prominently Roxine Latoya Plummer in her human incarnation, and Pandora is one of the vaguely fascistic clerics who imprisoned PG to begin with. The Canadian special effects house Masters FX gets a production card at the beginning of the film, so it's no surprise that PsychoGoreMan is crammed with elaborately designed monsters, all the way from the quite impressive PsychoGoreMan makeup itself to Pandora's cheesier but still attractive future Valkyrie look to the just plain silly, like a corpse grinder, garbage can robot that squirts gouts of blood from its arms. I get the feeling they just had a bunch of costumes lying around from goofy side projects and decided to plow them all into this one film. This is all good fun. Unfortunately, the fun is modulated by the effect our protagonist Mimi has on the film. I get what writer-director Stephen Kostansky was going for with the girl, making her an overconfident, self-involved anti-hero who eventually learns a lesson in empathy, but actress Nita Josie Hanna can't quite capture the nuances that would make the audience invested in her, regardless of her flaws. She overplays her role in a way that makes her less a plucky, Miyazaki-style heroine, and more Willy Wonka's obnoxiously spoiled Veruca Salt. That's a rather big stumbling block in letting us just enjoy PG PsychoGoreMan's unabashed irreverence. Still, any film that gets you to root for a monster going on a city-leveling rampage is okay in my book. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. Before we get started, a reminder that the next session of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will be March 23rd at 7 p.m. Eastern Time and will feature the great and wonderful writer Karen Russell. The event will be on Facebook and YouTube. We'll have full details at the end of the show. Nicole Glover works as a user experience researcher in Virginia. She believes that libraries are magical places and that problems seem smaller with a cup of tea in hand. Her life outside of books includes bicycles, video games, and baking the perfect banana bread. The Conductors is her debut novel. Can you give us a précis of what The Conductors is about?
It follows a pair of former Underground Railroad conductors who've, you know, they spent their years, you know, doing all the things, ferrying people from through slavery to freedom, doing some stuff in Civil War. And this book takes place in 1871 in Philadelphia. And so they're done with the war, things putting their past behind them, settling down to new lives, and basically decide they take their skills and solve murder mysteries. And they do that with, you know, this their general, you know, smarts and wits, as well as magic, because there's also, in addition to murder in this world, there's a bunch of magical mysteries to take care of. And so this book centers around the murder of a close friend that they discovered, and they basically, the book kind of details the fallout from this, seeing how the impact of this death impacts their lives, their friends' lives, and well as the community. And in addition to all that, it's kind of exploring the history of that time period with a fun level of, you know, the magic and murder sides to it as well.
Chapter 1. May, 1871. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. When the wagon rolled into view, Hetty took another small step along the tree branch. Lookout was not a role she would have chosen, but Benji had argued a trap was useless if it wasn't sprung in the right moment. Someone needed to watch the road, or trouble would be the only thing they caught. If the stars were so willing, Elle could have made a proper lookout. But at the sight of the wagon, the girl clutched her branch so tightly that it was a challenge to find where girl ended and tree started. The younger girl was one of the dozen or so people who had gone missing over the course of 2 days, and so far was the only one to have escaped. Hetty and Benji just thought the missing girl's trail had gone cold when Elle stumbled out of the woods, frantic for help. Not realizing they had been looking for her, Elle told them everything without hesitation, confirming what they already knew. She had been approached by a kind face, led out of safety and trapped before she even knew a trick was in play. But the only thing they didn't know was carried in her breathless words, details that changed their approach entirely. After years of ferrying people to safety from white slave catchers, they assumed these kidnappers were cut from the same cloth. They were wrong. The men driving the wagon could have been one of their neighbors, someone they'd seen as they went on their business throughout town. Although Hetty did not know these particular men, not even their names, learning this detail stung like a friend smiling as they told your secrets to your worst enemy. Below her, the bushes rustled as Benji hurried to finish the last of his spells. Hetty silently urged him on as the wagon drew nearer. If they had been working in tandem, the spells would be primed and ready. But as this was not the first time they'd done this, Hetty knew that stopping the wagon was the least important part. The driver's head had just passed under her feet when Hetty let a crow's caw escape her throat. She projected her voice as if she had a crowd eagerly listening as she spun tales for their enjoyment. Trees some distance away stirred with confused crows, but farther along the road, the bushes stopped moving. Benji stepped to the side and slammed his hammer onto the sigil scratched into the dirt. Light flashed from the strike, and dust flew into the air. The trees across from Hetty's hiding spot swayed until 3 of them dropped like dogs onto a bone. Wheels squealed and the horse cried out in alarm. The wagon veered to the side and the driver swore as he did his best to avoid the pile of trees. The moment it shuddered to a stop, 2 men jumped out of the back of the wagon to yell at the driver. As the dust settled, Benji tucked the hammer away, but before he approached the trio, he reached up and tugged his left ear. Hetty rolled her eyes. Clearly, he still remembered the last time they pulled a stunt like this. But she would have lingered on her perch a bit longer, even without his warning. Their plan had not accounted for 3 men being on the wagon, nor did it consider the guns the men held in their hands. The swearing stopped when Benji drew near. One of the guns turned his way, but Benji grinned and greeted the trio with a rolling drawl he brought out for these occasions. For some reason, it seemed to put people at ease. Hetty's husband was imposing, even when he tried not to be. He wore his past labors on broad shoulders and held his head high with full confidence as he made his way in the world. "You fellas look to be in a spot of bad luck," Benji said. "Need some help getting those trees out of the way? Can't move them, but my pappy taught me a good chopping spell to turn them into firewood." While Benji held the trio's attention with a rambling story Hetty had invented, she launched into the next stage of the plan. Hetty swung off the branch, soundlessly dropping from the tree to the ground. The wagon's doors were partially open when she reached it. With care, Hetty nudged them a bit wider so she could slip inside. Beams of dying sunlight caught the eyes of the dozen men and women seated around a log. Like a fat spider in the middle of its web, ropes sprouted from the log to bind each person's hands together so that not even the smallest of fingers could twitch. This was not as terrible as she expected, but it came mighty close. Hetty took another step into the wagon. Her appearance sent a shiver through the group. When the man closest to her made to speak, Hetty raised one finger to her lips. The only noise she heard was Benji's rambling, so she drew the crow star sigil into the air. A simple square with a short line extending from one corner, the sigil shimmered in the air for only a moment before Hetty gave life to the constellation. Suddenly, instead of lines and vertices, a crow hovered in the air, silently flapping its wings. Unlike a true crow, this one did not have ink-black feathers. The star sigil was a deep midnight blue, from its beak to its tail feathers, speckled with starlight that twinkled even when it stood still. The star sigil looped circles inside the wagon, slicing through bindings and unraveling the web of ropes. As the crow did its work, Hetty held out a coin with the dipper emblazoned on one side. Gesturing toward the open door, she pointed at the road back to town. Most blinked back at her, but an older woman stood up and took the coin from her. She gave Hetty a hearty wink and then held the coin toward the sky. The coin flashed at once. Ursa Minor took form in front of the woman before shifting into a shower of pale purple light. At the sight, the reluctance in the group melted away. They might not have seen Hetty before, but they had heard the stories of people like her. They knew they were not the first people Hetty had freed. The older woman held her hand toward the man closest to her. After Hetty urged him with a look, he took it. Others followed, grabbing each other's hands. One by one, the magic of the coin vanished them from sight, like a veil of invisibility had been tossed over them. When the last person disappeared into the woods, Hetty directed the crow upward. With a swish of her hand, she imploded the spell, letting loose the magic in a blazing light. The men outside swore. There was a thump, and then a gunshot split the air. The horse started at the sound, and its neighs added to the sudden chaos. But it was the second flash of light that got Hetty moving. She ducked around the wagon, holding out a sharp hairpin. A bullet struck tree bark inches from Benji's head. He ignored it and flicked his fingers into a series of star sigils, forming them so quickly that Hetty got only a faint impression of their shape. The spells shot from his hands and struck the man in front of him. Another man was already on the ground, moaning as he clutched a hand more in pieces than whole. And the third? The third man was frantically cramming bullets into a pistol. Hetty jammed the hairpin into his arm. The man yelped, falling to his knees. Hetty jumped back. she ran a finger along the cotton band at her neck, calling on the Taurus star sigil she had sewn into the stitches. Wrenching out the pin, the man stared at it and then at her. His mouth was still twisted over some crude word when Hetty's spell sent him flying into a tree. The man slipped to the ground, out like a snuffed candle.
"Too bad you can't do that spell from a distance," Benji said, tossing the knocked-out men to join the third. The pair hit the tree trunk with a thud. None woke up.
"If I could do anything from a distance," Hetty reminded him, "I would have pinned them with a sleeping spell from the start, and we could have avoided all this trouble."
Her husband snorted. "Certainly would have made things easier."
A star-speckled wolf loped over, carrying in its mouth the binding ropes from the wagon. It stopped near the three men and shook itself briefly before vanishing. The ropes fell on the men and then knotted together, binding wrists and ankles with a precision as sure as if done by hand.
"Plan still worked," Hetty said.
"We've done this before," Benji said, shrugging, "and this time we didn't need to be as careful."
He cast a glance around the clearing.
"Everyone on their way?"
Hetty pointed upward.
"Except for one."
Up in the tree, Elle had a death grip on the branch, but a new wariness entered her eyes as Hetty approached.
"Who are you people?" Elle stammered. "You summon birds, walk into gunfire with little paws, and make people vanish into the air. I thought when I ran into you, it was luck."
"Hardly luck," Benji scoffed. "We were looking for you."
The girl emitted a small squeak and pressed her face back into the tree bark.
"A friend of ours sent us looking for you," Hetty called up to Elle. "Miss Penelope."
The name did the trick. Elle's eyes opened and her grip relaxed so she merely held the tree instead of squeezing life from it.
"Who are you?"
she repeated. Curiosity bloomed in her eyes, overshadowing the fear. Hetty held out a hand to the girl, much as she'd done many times before, and said, "Someone here to help."
So the setting is, as far as popular media is concerned, an underexplored one. On an era and a fact is mostly denied.
When I was in school, the Reconstruction era was probably like a paragraph, a page, if I'm being generous.
No, and, yeah, except that, you know, they added that Andrew Jackson was a good guy.
Some of the books still like that, at least I remember when I was in school. Yes, it depends where you go, basically, and probably some of them probably about the same. I think there's an attempt to make them better is with anything, but... it's, you don't know. It's hard to say. Yeah. I don't have any kids in school, right? I don't have kids, so I don't know what they're teaching, right? These kids today, basically.
Yeah.
But the internet's really helpful, though, because it's interesting as I gotten, like, new logged into social media and stuff, even seeing people, like, figuring out pieces of history that I've, like, basically, you know, people say, like, learn today, these blog posts, basically, being, like, they learn these certain facts, and social media allows at least things that aren't really covered in school can be kind of blown up on the internet. It gets people interested to do their own research because everything's still out there. It's still out there. Just not, it's really hard to find.
Yeah. And the internet does provide conversation. The problem is that, of course, without a good mediator, an editor of some kind, you get so much of the bad. Mm. Along with the good, as we know all too well. Add to that mystery and magic. Mm. And it seems like a great combination.
It just kind of came together. Like, it was, I got this idea randomly. It was like, this worked really well. I don't know. This is something different, I think, because I don't really see too many media that's popular that's specifically stated after the Civil War. You might get little post-Civil War flashbacks and epilogues on these stories. But a lot of the particularly with Black history, it's set in 19th century. It's going to be antebellum. It's going to be Civil War. You're not going to really see Reconstruction era as much and anything, especially for fairly close after Civil War. And I think the only thing in depth I remember seeing is probably like the old Roots series, miniseries. I mean, they have a sequel, The Next Generation.
Yeah.
And they got covers like, you know, the post-Civil War to, I guess, to the 70s when the author, I guess the end of the author, basically, starting to write the original book. But that's probably like one of the few pieces of media that at least I was able to find easily. There's probably a few other ones, probably some TV movies out there that are specifically set in that time period, but all the big Hollywood movies, big TV shows aren't in that time period, which leads to a lot of, like, it's a lot of untold stories. And a lot of interesting things came in, because when I started writing, I just found a lot of interesting things, like, just in the few years, like, in the 1870s, is like so much stuff going on that I didn't include all of it in the book, because I was focusing on just the lives of the characters instead of, like, the larger world, but there are a lot of things going on. It's interesting. And so much is all across the country. Because it's like except one thing I found in the research is like it's a very important time period. And it's like so important that it's the stuff that was written about that time period by the writers of that decade is still relevant today.
Yes.
Like you just change names, change the dates. It's still very important.
It is. It is. And very much set a lot of the time frame things going on today. I live in a particular part of Brooklyn where not five blocks from me is a church that deconsecrated church that boasted that it served both Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee at the same time. And there were statues to that extent. Those are gone. But within 3 miles of where I live, they're totally rebuilding this formerly run-down neighborhood, good commercial neighborhood near Fulton Street. And there's one huge pit there. It's where there could be and probably will be a, you know, 30, 40-story building. But there's this shack. And the reason the shack hasn't been developed is to stop on the Underground Railroad. And it's dilapidated. But the owners, I think they've crowdfunded to hold on to that and keep that. And the great wish is for that to be developed into a museum.
Right.
And there certainly needs to be one. Where? I'm not sure. New York was a pretty active place for the railroad. But it's the fact that in the last year, so especially since the Black Lives Matter movement finally became a mainstream thing, people are questioning the statues there. On the Muppet Show on the Disney Channel, they put a disclaimer before Johnny Cash comes out and sings a song with a Confederate flag behind him.
Oh, I didn't know that was. I guess I heard about they had put the disclaimer on some of the episodes yet, but I hadn't got a chance to look at them yet. So I guess.
Oh, it only came up last week.
Yeah.
And I saw people can go to YouTube and see that particular clip.
Yeah.
And I think that if Johnny Cash were to do that today, he would rethink what was behind him. But it was just basically a whole lot of detritus. But the point is that what was going on then has become part of the station, more so than it was, say, 10 years ago. And so that's a way of saying I think The Conductors is a book whose time has come. Also, It seems very, it seems like there's a lot more than one story than this novel. And by the way, let me mention to people, I got the book last week. I finished it last week. It's a page turner. It's fun. You know, there's a lot of serious stuff going on, but it's still fun.
That was my main thing kind of going in there, especially when they have the magic in there. It has to be fun, at least for me, for writing it.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, it's, I want to have a good, I always have a, I guess that's how my approach for everything, like a mix of everything. It can be serious, but I like to have fun with my stuff.
Yeah. And so it seems to me, I know that you're working on a sequel.
Yeah, right? I just turned that in.
You did. Congratulations. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Do they have a pub date on that?
Right now, it's in November. This year.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
It is exciting. It's always nice to have, you know, well, one thing's nice to say, two books out in 1 year. It's always nice to say. And it's also, it shortens for readers too. It shortens the time between books.
I know.
And I know a lot of people like that as well.
Yeah. We were talking, I think, off air about how sometimes you want to not watch something on TV or something so that you can take it all in, especially the, you know, the first or the last episodes in a mini binge or micro binge. Mm-hmm. And there are too many writers, Michael Moorcock coming to mind, Philip Jose Farmer, another, where you might get 2 or 3 years in between volume 1 and volume 2. And with George Martin, it can be a decade.
Yeah.
Just about.
Right.
So that's great to have 2 books in 1 year. Do you have other tasks for your characters? Do you have other stories?
I always have a bunch of story ideas. It's always, I always keep a list of stuff of things I, they're in like in the view of things I want to work on eventually, or this thing is, a lot of things as I did this research, a lot of things captured my attention that I'd like to write about, but it didn't fit in these 2 books. That, cause I always had like a ton of stuff, like I don't want to overstuff things, so a lot of that stuff ends up being in the file. Things would be great to kind of build out, and I have a few things I would want to work on. So it's like, it just depends. It's right now just it's the waiting. It's a we'll see mode for the with these books. So
yeah. Will most of these involve Hetty and Benji?
Yeah, I've at least got 2 ideas for 2 more, and there's a few other ones. Because I have a lot of fun with this world, and I think that one benefit to, I mean, it's a mystery series. I also do a really short period of time, because the first book was maybe, this was just over a week of time. So it's like, yeah, it's easy to kind of, there's lots of room, basically. It just depends, like, as long as I have the ideas for stuff, as long as I have the idea for a good murder. I always have really careful, like, building out the mystery if it gets too complicated. I mean, there's nothing really I can say at the moment there, but it's, yeah, it's always, if anything, if you want to see your book turned in with actual actors and stuff in there. So either a movie or a TV series. I mean, I can easily see a movie being like a, you know, just following the book, and the TV series taking more of the concepts, mm-hmm, and, like, you know, it's building out individual murders per year episodes with the overarching thing. But you know, I dabbled at one point at like messing around with TV scripts. So I got thinking like, how would a TV script be how would I do a TV adaptation, mostly because I was thinking, you know, just thinking as, you know, big dreams, that sort of thing.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name's Jim Freund, and we now continue with an interview with Nicole Glover, recorded February 24th. How did you get drawn to genre?
It was writing. I mean, not writing, it was reading. It was, I've always been a big reader and stuff. I probably read some, like, you know, a lot of the classic children's fantasy when I was younger, but I think I didn't remember specifically seeking out, like, fantasy and science fiction until I started reading, of all things, Anne McCaffrey's Pern books, mm-hmm, Dragon Rider books. The reason I read those...
Way books. Those will bring people in.
Yeah, but I only started picking them up because they were the colorful covers in my library at the middle school. They had, they were stacked, it was in the middle of the library stack. I remember the, of the library bookcases. So I always pass them to get to the checkout desk, and they're really brightly colored. And they're right at eye length. So I was like, these looked interesting. So what are these about? And so I just got one, and I started getting the rest of them. And the funny thing is, I think for about, for this whole time I had noticed them, none of the books ever moved. But until I started reading them, after, not long after that, other people had picked up the books and checked them out as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, but anyway, that was my gateway into fantasy, even though I really did think it was fantasy because, you know, it was dragons, until I realized later on that it was actually science fiction because of the reveals I had later on in the series. But from there, I got more interested in reading more in that speculative, the speculative fiction area.
Yeah.
So from there, it's like, it's all she wrote. It's like a lot of the things I still read today, I still lean towards fantasy more and science fiction more than all the other genres, even though I do read, try to read as much broadly as possible.
Yeah, it's always a good thing. Who are some of the other writers that you've been reading then or now?
I guess we'll start with the now, since that's more recent in my mind. Now, Rebecca Roan Horses is a big one. I think I read Black Sun recently. And I was like, that's everything I ever wanted in epic fantasy. Yeah. Like, it was so good. I can wait for the second one. I'm still digesting what happened in the first.
I haven't interviewed her. I'll have to do that. I'll see if I can find an in.
let's see. P. Delgi Clark as well.
Yeah,
I love his novellas. Is like, he does so well in short fiction. I'm envious of it because I always have the tendency to overwrite. And he does like the plot of a very vivid world in such a short amount of pages that I still am left wanting to see more of this stuff. So I'm really happy that this first full novel is coming out this year. So I can't wait to read.
Although I like the fact that he works with different. I'm a big fan of, well, epics. I can run God knows how many thousands of pages, but I'm also a big fan of, you know, things that can run 16 or 60 pages. They each offer different things. And P. Jelly Clark has just sort of mastered the novella.
Yeah, it's like because I wasn't really a big fan of novellas before. I think I really started picking up his books. I think I only really picked up most because I saw the concepts he had for, like, the premise looked interesting. But after that, I had more respect for the novella afterwards, like seeing how much you can do with it, basically.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with it all, of course, is the market.
Mm-hmm.
Publishers want novels.
I do know more readers have been talking about like shorter stuff now. I guess especially since the big doorstopper novels have been such a thing for all these years and long running series that keep going on and on. That there's people want more, I guess less of a commitment basically. They want something to be more. I've been hearing readers saying they want more standalones. They want more shorter stories basically.
Yeah, and that's something the internet has helped with as well. Because in the era of science fiction where I was reading it, the gateway were the magazines, Galaxy Magazine, yeah. Amazing Stories, Analog, and the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, etc. And now you have the internet. Now, and the internet allows any length. So that's where you get things like Clark's World and the three podcasts that I'm associated with for John Joseph Adams, who's publishing, a dozen short stories every month between the three magazines and his anthologies. And he's been doing novels through John Joseph Adams Books. And the short story and the novella and these forms are very much alive. And there also a few people breaking media rules in what they do, like Andrea Hairston creating works that have to have music.
Mm-hmm.
And Kat Valenti has done that as well in collaboration. For some reason, it seems to work better with fantasy than with science fiction. I don't know why.
I guess fantasy is more anything kind of goes. I think so. I know there's a lot of science fiction. There's still more like you want to be somewhat grounded a bit than before. Compared to fantasy, I guess, or at least fantasy has allowed more. You want to hear, since it's you're describing things that it's hard to say. So having like an audio, something audio kind of helps out a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm being an audio person. I'm always going to be happy to hear that. You mentioned that you do UX, which in my day we simply called interface design. What kind of UX do you do?
I'm basically mostly on web, a little bit on apps, because the website I work for has a really strong app press. Well, not strong. I have a really dedicated app presence for certain things, but it's kind of mostly just working. It's just a typical website is making things a little bit better, like making things easy for users to find. Screen closes. It's also just to be able to find certain things, like, you know, it's whether to find the lead form we have on the site, so finding information. A lot of sometimes it's just collecting information about the visitors to the site themselves, like whether it's from demographic stuff to things that they're interested in buying, defining their user journeys, basically, because there's like several different user journeys that people can make on the site and kind of figure out what those could be to kind of better serve them and figure out certain products. And yeah, there's a bunch of little things like that. It's always kind of fun. And it's one that's a field that kind of came
from. Isn't it? Yeah. There's sort of a gaming aspect to that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's a lot of things that, I mean, especially when you look at some of the metrics for a month, the aspect does come up a bit. You get a certain pleasure of seeing people actually are finding the button or the page that we want them to find. It's just seeing the numbers go up or down depending on certain things is always kind of fun.
Now, speaking of websites and stuff, you have a very nice one. We should just tell people it's nicole-glover.com. You see, there's the UX in radios that you have to say. Dash. So it's nicole-glover.com. You can figure out the .com for yourself, listeners and viewers. Does your background in psychology interact with the UX experience and your writing and...
Oh yeah, all the way over. I think I got interested in psychology because I liked to write. Because I've always been a writer since I was younger, and so I was always interested in why people did certain things. Why they like what they're thinking, basically. So when I went to school, off the school, like, you know, psychology felt like a really good fit, and definitely UX. Yeah, with UX, psychology is basically, you know, it's a marriage of UX, the marriage of psychology, art, and computers. So it was one of the kind of funny. I guess kind of stumbled into UX as a field by accident. Like, I just read the book and I was like, oh, this is a. Then I was talking about kind of user interfaces and all this other design stuff. Like, this is actually a field with computers. Like, why didn't I learn about this when I was in college? Mm-hmm. And from there, yeah. But yeah, definitely psychology is a thing. And I'm always curious about why people do certain things. And yeah, I think that's the kind of approach I take with writing. Like, you know, like. A lot of times to figure out, like, why people are doing that, what are you thinking, like, what your actions are, and all this other stuff just fascinates me.
Yeah, and to me, this is all coming together into who you are, because you've got a background in psychology, in user experience, this interest in... The antebellum era and magic, and it all ties together very nicely. And it's almost a shock that I don't think I've ever encountered anything quite like it before. And it's just so easy to pick up and go through. And by the way, how much of this, I mean, it's not been done that I can think of offhand, period, and especially not in Black literature. One should point out, these books are readable by anybody and everybody.
It's good to hear. It's, I don't know, it's always felt like a, I think especially with all the different genres and mashing up together, it's like, oh, this is probably a lot. Because I always felt like, when I started, like, you know, pitching out to people, like, you know, describing, like, give you a quick summary of what it is, I'm like, oh, it's a historical fantasy, like, murder mystery. And I feel like that's a lot of words. It's all because of all these different genres clashing together. But each, you know, each genre, like, it counts. I make sure that each, I have emphasis on each genre in there. And, you know, it's, I don't know if it's the first. There's probably lots. I mean, there's lots of books I haven't read out there that maybe it's kind of tackled some similar things, but.
You know, I'm sure that there's something in what I don't know, and I'm fairly well read, but especially in the genres. But what I don't know, I'm sure there's a listener out there who can tell us something. Or if you're viewing this on Facebook or something, you know, type in an example. But to me, this was unique. That's what got me from the pitch that I was sent by your publicist. So I'm so glad that I did. And you notice that I'm just saying your books, because I'm living in my head in a future where you've got this empire of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I got enough ideas for that. I think it's funny when I remember busy, because when I was editing and like working on the second book, I had started writing a list of all the ideas I had, like, for different stories on the side. Because that's what happens when you're busy with something. You get a bunch of ideas for new projects. And so, you know, I think I had like a nice little healthy list of things I wanted to write, things I wanted to need to research, basically. And, you know, I always wanted to be a writer from a kid, I think, in the sense that I always, you know, once I realized that's a job you could do as of being an author, and, you know, there's people who write the books I read, they are the actual real people. So, like, you know, my desire was as a kid, you know, had my name on the book somewhere. And I think I always imagined several books, you know, because I think I used to make lists of like a, I was really good at like making titles and series. When I started like my little stories I did as a kid, I remember I made a printout of like potential titles for, you know, books I never wrote. I had ideas for, and it was like at least maybe a 2 pages of stuff of just titles of potential book ideas. So like I always have a dream of lots of books in the future. Just, you know, I'd have to find the time to write them all.
Now we've established that this is a very rich universe that you're not going to be abandoning very quickly. But I'm wondering if there are other universes or one shots or things that you have in mind that you might get around to tackling.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I did want to write a kind of secondary world kind of story. You know, it's more, mm-hmm. more in lines of epic fantasy, in the sense that I can like go have free, less structured like magic and just do whatever I want kind of thing. You know, it's like more like a, not really tied. So I won't be tied to like the history and stuff. But it's like, in some ways it is a box to be careful on, but I want to, you know, have kind of run around and have fun with that. And I think eventually I want to do like a space opera in a sense. You know, it's like more of a space thing. I've always been big on space. And I guess, I don't know, I guess between like watching this new Star Wars and like Expanse series and stuff like that, I was interested in like, you know, doing something in space, even though I haven't really been, I guess I mostly want to do more, try to do a little bit more with science fiction. I did a lot of my stories have been fantasy. And I think, and also, you know, have fun with more contemporary realistic fiction, of course, you know, just to, because there's different stakes when you're writing more realistic fiction. Mm-hmm. Than you know, fantasy and science fiction. You know, with fantasy, you know, the world's ending, or there's this magic bad guy you have to stop, or, you know, this particular spell that's going awry in your life. Whereas, you know, realistic fiction has more, I mean, they, you have like big states that seem on the outside small stakes, but it's like a different, I think it's, well, I guess most of it's more about character stuff. That's interesting character work. That's, it'd be kind of fun to pull back on and just to kind of mess around. And, you know, I don't know if I'll do like a traditional mystery at all. I think all my mysteries will probably be the magical mystery vein that I like doing it, because that's lots of fun and stuff, but who knows?
Yeah.
Anything that catches my interest, I probably want to try to write. I think I find a lot of things end up writing are things that interest me, or things I dislike and want to make my own spin on, or things that I want to, that they're doing and I wanted to make my own, like, stamp, put my own trademark stuff on. But
yeah, I can see that. I think this is a wonderful start. Mm-hmm. And I wish you the best with it. I think it'll get it. We should mention the official publication date probably is passed by the time we get to broadcast. Is it March 2nd?
Yes, March 2nd in the U.S. And for any U.K. just listeners, it's out on the 3rd of the March 4th. So,
let me mention to viewers and listeners, if you go to cold-lover.com, you can see the cover of the UK edition of the book. And it's very interesting how different it is and yet uses similar icons that one would associate, I guess, with the Underground Railroad. Very different types of art, both of them very expressive.
Yeah, it's interesting to me too. I've heard that was going to get, well, I got, so I never thought I was going to actually have it be published out in the UK. I just thought it was going to be US only. You know, I think I'm very history, like, you know, it's like, it's not going to appeal to people outside of the US, but I got excited when I heard about the UK version, especially when they have a new cover. Cause I always know new covers are like, you know, collecting things. It's like, it's always fun. So I started looking up, like, I guess I was curious looking at differences between the U.S. and U.K. covers. And it's actually a big deal. Like, I came across people blogs talking about differences between different countries. And I think some of it's like, you know, market-based, though it can get interest and stuff. But I was just intrigued by how, like, the different interpretation of certain things come out differently, whether it's in the U.S. or U.K. And just, you know, it's I guess I like the designs of, like, looking at stuff, so.
It'll be really interesting to see if this gets any foreign language versions, and not only how will the translation be, but what will the cover look like? What will the imagery look like?
Yeah, definitely. I haven't heard anything about that yet, but I'm definitely, it's one of the things I would like to see. Getting himself the foreign translation is always kind of fun. Yeah. I mean, it's also accessibility for, like, different countries as well. But I don't think until I got plugged into the publishing that I didn't realize the differences worldwide, how people get books. It's vastly different than I'm used to. They don't have not many people have really good library systems like that I have here around. So it's like, it's different. So, but yeah, anyway, it'd be fascinating to see when any kind of international covers come out one day. And of course, I'll have them displayed on my website because it's the thing I like to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we can wrap up. Is there anything you want to, anything I haven't asked, anything you want to talk about?
That'd be covered a lot. I would think of it. It had lists and it'd be covered a lot that was on there.
Yeah. So I guess at this point, I'll just say thank you so much for doing this. And again, for everybody, the name of the first book in the series is The Conductors. The author is Nicole Glover. I don't know why I want to say Glover. It's wrong. Glover. Glover. And available wherever better books are sold.
Yeah.
And audiobook.
Yeah.
So, again, thank you very much.
It was fun talking.
Good. Take care. Have a good day. You've been listening to an interview with Nicole Glover, whose debut novel, The Conductors, has just come into print from Mariner Books, edited by my colleague, John Joseph Adams. A video of the extended interview is available on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group, as well as YouTube in the videos section for Jim Freund. That's F-R-E-U-N-D. And a reminder that the next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will convene March 23rd at 7 p.m. New York time with fiction writer and journalist Karen Russell. This event is live in both my YouTube video library and the NYRSF Readings Facebook group. Please join us. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next Saturday at 7 a.m. Stay tuned for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Good morning.
WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. You just heard Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. After a little station business, you'll hear Any Saturday with David Rothenberg at 8 o'clock. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Julian Gioiello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
Korea with Bobby McFerrin on an album entitled Rendezvous in New York. And in this time of COVID here in New York, most New Yorkers are wearing face masks. But then there's the guy on the street corner smoking a cigarette, not wearing a mask. The woman talking on her cell phone who thinks the person on the other end won't hear unless she pulls her mask off. And what about that couple who walk by? A woman's mask is below her mouth and the guy's mask is below his nose. Well, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has now recommended that we wear two face masks because of variant strains of the virus. And for masks to fit snugly, a cotton mask on top of a surgical mask may offer 95% protection from exposure to aerosols and tiny particles that could contain the coronavirus. Well, WBAI has 100% cotton masks for you with our logo and the saying, keep free speech radio alive. We have these for you. You can wear these over other masks for better protection. They are washable and come in white or black. Please call 516-620-3602 to order your cotton face mask for a tax-deductible contribution of $35 or buy two masks for $70. You can also go to our donation site. Go to give2wbai.org to order your WBAI face masks. Again, the phone number is 516-620-3602. You'll be helping to keep Free Speech Radio alive here on WBAI in New York. On the WBAI Playhouse Saturday from 7 to 9 p.m., it's the story of Rosalind Franklin, one of the 21st century's unsung women scientists. Her photographic image of the DNA double helix gave rise to modern molecular biology.
It's a helix!
I know!
Gosling!
It's incredible!
Never seen anything like it. Photograph 51.
Miriam Margolyes stars as Rosalind Franklin in Anna Ziegler's biographical study of the struggle and the triumph of this woman scientist and of Photo 51. Next time on the WBAI Playhouse, presented by LA Theater Works, that's Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. here on WBAI New York.
The next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting is Sunday, March 21st, 2021, at 1 p.m. The meeting will be held by teleconference. The call-in number is 623-600-3766. The access number is 963-003. Also, the CAB will hold officer elections at the May meeting. The election will be for chair, vice chair, and recording secretary. In order to vote in the election, you have to be a CAB member. To be a CAB member, you have to be a member of WBAI. You will have to attend the next three CAB meetings and take part in the meetings. Again, the call-in number is 623-600-3766. The access number is 963-003.
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you'll even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them, a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, soft. Little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing.
Just then the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing south to the border down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now, you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You start off each day with a song.
Jimmy DeRandy, who ushers us in every Saturday morning. I wanted to call him and ask him to invite Hit Him in the Head Schwartz to make an appearance. But alas, they're all gone. I'm David Rothenberg. It's any Saturday on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. It's Saturday, March 13th. And I looked at the calendar. My grandmother, Molly Stern, born 133 years ago on this day. 1888. I find it astounding that here in 2021 that I was shaped and influenced by a woman who was shaped and influenced, born in the end of the 19th century. Life is mysterious and wonderful. In the second hour this morning, we'll be talking with Pascal Shakur Charpentier, who many of you may talk to us last when he was in a ICE detention center in Bergen County, New Jersey. He's been released and is on recognizant, but the story is not over. And I hope you stay tuned for the second hour to hear this extraordinary tale of this decent, kind, and wonderful man. It's also been a week in which the media is dealing with the first anniversary of the lockdown of the pandemic as if it's a, well, not an event of celebration, but the media is always looking for anniversaries to do a review. The Arts and Leisure section in tomorrow's New York Times, obviously they all took the week off, got some paste and some old pictures and threw it together, celebrating 1 year of a lockdown. It's, or observing 1 year of a lockdown. I started thinking about the what were the aspects of this year that had the great that have a lasting impact on me. Certainly, the most memorable was going down to the health clinic down the block from me for 2 or 3 months every night at 7 o'clock. I remember the first night I heard noise and I looked out the window and I saw 2 fire trucks in front of the health center and I thought, oh my God, with all that's going on, we have a fire there. And the next night I saw the fire trucks again. And I went downstairs and I said, what's cooking? And they said, at 7 o'clock, they're celebrating the people that are in there that are working. And on the side street were the trucks with the bodies that were frozen. It was just, we never even conceived that we could be going through something like this with our daily grumps and complaints. And to see this massive attack on our humanity worldwide, it was going. And so every night at 7, I dutifully went down there, put my hand over my heart and watched. And the young workers, and some not so young, came out and took a bow as we saluted them. And they really were extraordinary. They put themselves in the line of fire, and many got ill and many died. And I wonder if we ever know the extent to which they have sacrificed themselves to put themselves in the position of all over the country, the healthcare workers who worked with people who were dying and who were contagious. There was an extraordinary period. The other extreme you know, the other end of the, if you're noting the year, was the incoherent evil man in the White House. They showed a clip of him saying there's only 15 cases and we have it under control. It's a hoax. Use whatever that was, it Clorox or Drano. I don't know what he told people to do. Don't minimize masks. We'll be in church by Easter. And then after after he was defeated in November, completely put the whole issue of the quarantine, of the lockdown, of the COVID. It was not even a factor. It was all about the fact that he felt, though he lost by 7 million votes, that he was entitled to something, conspiring to overthrow the government. My feeling that he was, that the bombshell will be when that, well, that's another story. Texas Governor Abbott took off the masks. I saw the interview with the Austin mayor, who has been charged by the attorney general for disobeying orders, saying we have a 13% positivity rate. How can we act as if it's over by taking off the masks? He was serious and concerned. But of course, Abbott and other Republican, not all Republican governors, but the woman in South Dakota, the Yackel in Florida, who are tied to Trump at the hip, seemed determined to celebrate anti-science politics. But we had our heroes. We had the people who really extended themselves. I forgot one other thing. An outgrowth of this was Trump's constantly defining it as the China flu, creating an avalanche of anti-Asian violence and insults and idiocy. It's the same thing that happened to Mormons. To Muslims after 9/11. It happened to Mormons too in our history. It happens to every group. It's which is why I was so pleased when Al Sharpton, the Reverend Al Sharpton, joined with Asian leaders in a press conference, identifying the fact that when one person is discriminated or one group is discriminated against, it affects everybody. It's that famous quote from World War II in Germany, when they came for the socialists, I remained silent. When they came for the academics, I remained silent. When they came for the Jews, I remained silent. And when they came for me, there was no one left to speak up. Well, that's a pick-me-up. I hope that I made you feel like you want to stick around. Let's have some music.